I'm Andy Bolton from Tokyo Blade, and you are listening to the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast.
This is the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast, featuring all your favorite bands from the 70s and 80s. The old stuff, the new stuff, the news, interviews, everything you need for your hard rock and metal fix, right here, right now.
Tokyo Blade forms part of the new wave of British heavy metal alumni, producing a landmark debut album which was a definitive example of the early 80s heavy metal style. Like so many, though, with subsequent albums and tours, they were cursed with inadequate representation, predatory record companies, and plain bad luck, leaving them with literally no financial rewards for their efforts. Fast forward to 2011, and the original Blade lineup is back with a new lead singer, thanks in no small part to the tenacity of guitarist, songwriter, and founder member Andy Bolton. We talk through much of the band's history leading up to the recording of their first new album in 25 years, starting with his memories of that classic debut.
The whole thing really was a kind of a real labour of love from our point, and it did really well. It's much to our surprise, because actually when we got the first sort of white labels came through, we were really disappointed. You know, the sound wasn't good and it wasn't mixed properly, and we were very naive. We'd been told, oh, you know, don't worry about that, that'll be fixed in the mix, you know, it's all going to be okay. And it wasn't. We weren't happy about it at all, but it had, I suppose, looking back on it, that raw energy, the new wave of British heavy metal, half punk, half heavy metal kind of energy to it. And I think that's what people dug about the record, and that's why people bought it.
The album did pretty well, as you say, and you toured off the back of it, but then shortly afterwards you lost Alan Marsh, the vocalist, didn't you?
Basically, the record company just felt that he wasn't the right man for the band, and we did try to fight it, but Alan, for one thing, Alan was obviously quite hurt at what, you know, at some of the you know, things that they had to say, and I can't blame him for that, and it ended up with Alan saying, you know, I'll stuff it, I'm through with it, you know. And that was that. Now, the next thing, the next part of the story is, it hasn't very often been told. It's absolutely 100% true. We had a tour booked to support an Irish band called Mama's Boys. And it was a fairly big tour. For us, it was a big deal. And it was really moving up. They were playing sort of 2,000 or 3,000 seater venues every night. So this was big news for us, you know. But we had no singer. I mean, where do you go? All you could afford is a little ad in Melody Maker, you know. Established band need a singer, which is what we did, and we got sent so many tapes, and it was getting closer and closer and closer. Eventually we found out, one of the tapes that came in was from a guy called Vic Wright. To be honest, it was the only tape really that we'd been sent with any promise, you know. It was the only tape that we had with the guy could actually sing, and we felt that he was probably, you know, right for the band. He came down to Salisbury. He was from Bradford. He came down from Salisbury the night we were leaving for the tour, having never heard any of our stuff. And he turned up at, by the time he got from the train station to there, it was about 8:30. He walked in. One of the lads made him a cup of coffee. I sat him down in a chair, gave him my Walkman and all the lyrics, which I'd written out, and said, you've got till tomorrow night to learn them. And then about midnight, I think, we left. He sat in the van with the Walkman again and the lyrics and a little torch. And we drove to Dover, ferry across to Calais. Then things got really interesting. We were doing this tour on a shoestring. We had no money at all, as usual. Nothing. And our manager, we said to the manager, you know, how are we going to survive? How are we going to eat? He said, right, you've got a box of T-shirts here. We had some T-shirts printed, real cheap. And he said, That's your money. That's your money for everything. That's your money for your diesel, for your food, for everything. You know, you sell them, and you live. And if you don't, you don't. We got to France. We went through customs. We then drove away from the port and pulled into the first petrol station to fill up with diesel. Two police cars screamed to a halt behind us, or customs, confiscated our passports, ordered us back to the port. We went back to the port. They took everything out of the van, found the T-shirts, confiscated them, because in those days, of course, we would have been selling merchandise in France, and there was no EEC, so we were liable for the tax on that. So we had to pay a fine and hand over all the T-shirts. So the fine took care of every penny that we had, and the T-shirts took care of the T-shirts. So we were now in France, supporting a band with no money at all, not a bean, nothing. None of us had any money. No such thing as credit cards or anything like that. We didn't have them. And we got paid a little amount from each gig, which kept the diesel in the van. And for food, initially, we stole it. Our tour manager would go to a shop, and he would just walk through the shop and put whatever he could in his coat and come out the back. And we were living on bread and cheese and all the strangest combinations of meals, because it was whatever he could fit in his coat. So we were, you know, some days we'd be eating sort of strawberries and bread, and then the next day we'd be eating, I don't know, you know, cranberries and socks and whatever, you know, whatever he could find. To me, Tokyo Blade and bands like Tokyo Blade, we represent the underdog. We're the downtrodden and the kicked and the, you know, the working class. And what the fuck else am I going to do? You know, I didn't get to Cambridge quite, so, you know, there's nothing there. I don't know anybody that owns any multinational companies that's going to give me a sort of chairmanship or anything. So it's a case of carrying on doing what you're doing. And we do what we're doing because, first and foremost, we believe in what we do. If people don't like it, that's their problem. If people like it, great. We're happier still. And if you, let's be honest, if you can do what you do and enjoy it, I would rather scrape a living out of what I enjoy doing than work in some awful place where I spent half my life hating doing what I was doing. So for me, it's still a good job.
Can you see areas of that early period where crap happened to you that didn't happen to other bands, and they perhaps skipped across the stones, whereas you ended up going between them?
Very much so. Metallica being the case in point, I would say. We played with Metallica an awful lot, and we knew them, you know, we knew the guys personally. And for instance, Lars and James Hetfield would often stay at Andy's, our bass player's, house when they came across to London. They would stay there and we'd go out drinking together. And we were playing with them on the same festivals. There was no, it wasn't like, oh, we're playing with Metallica, because Metallica were the same level as us. But Metallica, what can I say? They had the right management. Being American, I think, helps, or helped then. More resources and more money. You know, for instance, I mean, these garage bands. We, you know, they start off in mum and dad's garage. Oh, if only, you know, if only. I mean, we lived in a council house. We didn't have a garage anyway. And if we had done, you know, the last thing the neighbours would have wanted would have been us in there. So just even from a rehearsal point of view, everything was a struggle. You know, we had to find a hall, and then you hoik all the gear down there, and then you start practicing, and then somebody from the village knocks on the door and says, "Do you know that my wife is trying to..." And then it's, you know, I'll get out of there and find another hall. And so it goes on. And even from that point of view, they had a garage to rehearse in. Wonderful, their own garage, you know, and they could rehearse there when they wanted. Leave their gear set up. Fantastic.
So as we sit here now, you've just spent a week down at Chris's studio in Dover with the guys. What was it like back in the studio with the old troupe again?
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Mental. Mental as ever. Childish, immature, all the things you love, all the things that us guys love. Childish, stupid, ridiculous. But what a time. What a laugh. I mean, you know, I was teaching at Winchester College, which is a very prestigious place to teach. I'm surprised they even let me in through the front door. You know, very respectable job, and, you know, a decent, you know, a little house and a little car, and, you know, sort of, well, that's it now, you know, just keep trooping away now till I retire, and that's it. And then the next thing, you're back with these guys that you haven't seen for 25 years, arsing around, just exactly the same. Nothing's changed. None of them have changed. It's exactly the same as it was. It's just like it's just a, like turning the clock back. Everybody's just as immature, just as stupid, just as many stupid practical jokes and bad cooking and farting and the whole horrible thing, you know, and drinking. And the only difference is that now, you know, we get to about 10 o'clock at night, we're all going, oh, you're so for bed, you know, whereas we used to be sort of 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning before we even thought about that. So that's changed.
God bless Tokyo Blade and every band like them is what I say. Do what you love and damn everyone else. That's got to be the way. Time now for the fruits of Blade's considerable labour with an exclusive preview of the new album, which is called 1,000 Men Strong. It'll be released in March. The track we have is called Lunch Case, a cheery tale of a serial killer who eats his victims.